Welcome to The Mental Breakdown, where we tackle all issues related to mental health, mental illness, parenting, schooling, relationships, and everything in between. While Drs. Bernie and Richard will provide the most up-to-date ideas and perspectives, the information provided in this podcast is not a substitute for medical care. Our goal here at The Mental Breakdown is to provide you with information to help you make your life the best it can be. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bernie and Dr. Richard. Welcome to episode 21 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
And here we are again, meeting, talking about anxiety again this week. We're going to continue our conversation from last week, where we were talking about anxiety disorders, but this week we're going to maybe talk about some of the more important stuff, which is, okay, now that we have an anxiety disorder, what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. Sound good to you?
What are the treatments?
Yes. What are the treatments?
And this is a good week. We keep this, we've been doing this countdown to the start of school.
Yes.
And last week was, well, we only have a week left. We only have 2 weeks left. Well, now we're down to days, right? Well, your children actually started.
Yes. Some of the private schools and charter schools started this past week.
Right.
So next week is, at least here in Polk County,
everybody's
next week is
back.
The start of everybody else.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, everybody will be in school starting next week.
Which is an anxiety-producing event.
It absolutely is.
Still is, even though they changed the tests, but we still have tests.
And you know, I love this idea of orientation.
Yeah.
So all the students go to orientation the week before or a few days before school starts. And you know, you go to the school as the parent, and you know, my son, this is his first year in high school. And so we're there, and there, it feels like 10,000 people in the hallways of this high school. And I'm thinking, there's got to be a better way to do this than
right.
trying to pack us all. And we're sweating. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's miserable.
That's what I remember about orientation. There was always hot.
It's always hot
and humid.
It's always hot and sweaty. And there was this one teacher. It was very funny. You know, the hallways in high school, for some reason, I remember them being wider than they actually are.
Because we were smaller.
We were smaller. And there were several teachers who, instead of having the parents and students come into their classrooms to meet with them, the teacher sat at the doorway and had the students and parents lined up outside. So not only is the hallway already compacted because there's 10,000 people trying to fit through there, but now you have this line forming of people who want to go talk to this teacher. It was horrible.
It's like passing Halloween candy out in your driveway.
I felt like we were sardines just packed into this narrow channel. I don't know what they were.
Well, the other, you know, besides start of school, we have to remember, too, that we only have about, 13 Fridays left until Christmas?
Yes.
Everybody's keeping track of how many Fridays there are until Christmas.
Right.
Speaking of anxiety-producing thoughts.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned that because, of course, we have a new therapist working, or she's a registered mental health intern working here in the office. And each week, Miss Cassie will give us an update. 147 days left to Christmas.
Oh, she's counting days.
Okay. So she hits me with that every... She knows exactly where she wants to put the Christmas tree.
Oh,
and yeah, she's already thinking about all of that. So, but before we get into the anxiety, there's a couple of announcements that I and things that I wanted to get out there to let people know about. So hopefully, just to keep everyone informed, our newspaper column, the Mental Breakdown newspaper column in the Ledger, it can be read at theledger.com under the Life section. If you just scroll down, you'll see a little picture of me. And it'll say the Mental Breakdown, and you'll see all of our newspaper columns there. Another easy way to get to it and to be able to see all of the newspaper columns that we've published, as well as our podcast, you can go to theledger.com/Bernie Wilkinson. So BERNEYWILKINSON. So theledger.com/Bernie Wilkinson, and that will have a list of all of the work that we've done with our friends over at The Ledger. The important thing that I was trying to get to about The Ledger is that our column moved to Sunday. How exciting is that?
As of last week, my mother was very happy about that.
So we were originally published on Saturdays, in the kind of buried in the life section, but our friends at the Ledger have moved us to the Sunday paper in the on the cover of the new friends and family section,
which we think was a brilliant decision on their part.
I think that that
I'm
was
sure you agree.
That was great. So we're very excited about that. So hopefully we'll be able to get the word out to more people, right, and more people will get to write into us, ask us questions, and engage in the conversation.
Right.
A second announcement is that we are starting a newsletter.
Right.
If you go to our practice website, which is PACFlorida, PACFLORIDA.com, PACFlorida.com, I have to rearrange it a little bit because it looks like on some browsers it's a little bit difficult to see, but you'll be able to sign up for our newsletter. We're going to publish a newsletter each month. This month is just sort of an introduction and say, hey, how you doing? This is us, and kind of give you a little bit of information about the different things that we do. But the important things that are going to be on the newsletter is going to announce our new monthly workshops. We're going to start having workshops every month, and you will be able to get all the information and the calendar of events and everything right there on the newsletter, delivered to your inbox on a monthly basis, so you can keep track of everything that we're doing. That's exciting.
That is.
Adding a little bit more work to our schedule, but we don't mind.
What else would we rather do?
That's right. It's Friday today, so that just means two more work days.
Two more work days until Monday.
Until we're back at it on Monday. So, is that all of the announcements for this week?
Workshop coming up.
Oh, that's right.
We have some workshops on the way.
This time, our workshop is covering anxiety, which
right.
brings us right back to our topic for the day.
And that's what's the date for that? September?
It's September
14th? 18th.
I think it's the 18th.
18th.
It's going to be on a Friday. I'll verify that before we finish up, just to make sure that we have it at the right time and we're letting you guys know the right time. But it's going to be on the topic that we're talking about today, which is anxiety.
Right.
So let's see how we're going to start off with this. Anxiety, as we talked about a little bit last week, anxiety is a complex disorder. It's a complex set of responses in our body. And I think that last week we may have been a little bit confusing. And so there's a few things that we want to clarify just to make sure that we help you understand everything about this condition and with what we're talking about.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Makes sense. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, this is a complicated topic. And one of the problems is it's related to other disorders. Anxiety is very closely related to depression. And we want to make sure that we sort these things out so that we're very clear and we help clarify rather than confuse.
Right. And the other issue is that all of the words that we use when we think about anxiety mm-hmm. are used in different contexts.
Right.
So when we think about the word stress, well, mm-hmm. when we talk about stress, we're talking about the response our body
right.
produces or, mm-hmm. or what happens in our body in response to some type of event, some type
right.
of stressor, which mm-hmm. is where one of the sources of the word stress
right.
anyways.
Right.
And so we use the words stress, fear, anxiety, worry in popular press or sort of in general conversation.
Right.
We use those words interchangeably. And what we're trying to talk about is differentiating them just a little bit. Because fear is different than stress.
Right.
Fear is our perception. You know, when you see a snake, you interpret that stimulus as a fearful stimulus.
That's right. And one person might look at a snake and be frightened.
Right.
That's their response. They see it as a danger, as a potential threat, as a potential danger. Another person will see the same snake and not have that response.
Right.
So when we define something as being dangerous, we are identifying it. That's fear.
Right.
That's our response to something.
Right.
Okay. But stress is the body's response to that interpretation.
Right. It's the body's response.
Right.
Not our
right.
cognitive response.
Right.
it's our body's response. Just a quick example, using a snake as an example. So a couple of weeks ago, I had a patient come in, a 17-year-old patient, or 16, 17-year-old patient. She comes in and she says, "I have a surprise for you." And I'm thinking, well, this will be interesting. I wonder what that means. And she says, "Hold out your hands and close your eyes." And I'm thinking, this better not be anything dangerous. So I do so. And I close my eyes and I hold my hands out. And I feel this strange feeling in my hands. And I open my eyes, and sure enough, there is a boa constrictor in my hands. She had just gone with her parents and bought this 3-foot snake that she was carrying in her backpack. And she's so excited about it because she loves it and all this. I can imagine how my mom would respond to that situation. If my mom were the therapist and sitting there, because she's terrified of snakes, she would experience a fear response that would send her almost into shutdown.
Right.
She would have thrown the snake. She would have been screaming. She would have run. Now, I don't mind snakes. So I'm holding it and I open my eyes and I think, you know, his color patterns are pretty cool. Mm-hmm. He's a nice looking snake. But it begins with our interpretation of the stimulus. Now, sometimes our brain, as we talked about last week, sometimes our brain makes those decisions for us.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And for people who have had traumatic experiences, sometimes we're in different situations. Mm-hmm. Our brain will make the decision about whether or not something is dangerous.
A sudden loud sound.
Right.
Bang, a pop, an explosion. Your brain automatically responds. It doesn't even get to the thinking part of your brain.
Right.
You just respond because your brain is going to assume that it's dangerous.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those are automatic responses that happen at the sub-brain level.
Right.
And we'll talk about that just to review that just here in just a second. But before that, or in other situations, like when you see a spider across the room, or you see, you know, a bear on the other side of the glass at the at the zoo or at the wildlife reserve, when you see that, you are able to process that information. And if you experience a fear response, then that is oftentimes based upon your cognitive interpretation of that situation.
Right.
There is nothing inherently dangerous about a test. Yet, when a student sits down and the teacher puts the test in front of them, they begin to have a stress response in their body.
Because they define the test as a threat.
A threat, right.
And once you define something as a threat, then your body will automatically start this stress response.
Right.
Whether it's a test or a python,
your
body is going to respond in this way. And they call that response stress.
Exactly.
Okay.
So we're spending a lot of time differentiating this, but I want to make sure, or we want to make sure that everybody understands that though we use these words interchangeably at times, these are different things.
Right.
Anxiety is a disorder. Stress response is a physiological, biological response to a stressor. Fear is an interpretation of a stimulus that we make based upon experience, based upon some other knowledge. And worry is feeling overwhelmed, feeling nervous, or feeling like, oh, I have a lot to do, and I'm worried that I'm not going to be. It's sort of a low-level underlying stress.
Yeah, you're not responding to something in your environment.
Right.
And that's different. You know, sort of worry is sort of this internal process, not a response to something outside.
Right. Worry is, I'm thinking about all the things I have to do. There's nothing in front of me.
I'm doing this to myself.
Right. So again, we use these words interchangeably, but they're really very different things.
And when we use the word stress, Dr. Burney and I are usually referring to this physiologic response.
Right.
You know, we might say I'm stressed, but when we use the word stress, we're referring to a biological response.
Right. That's here. Now, when we're working with patients, of course, we try to use the vocabulary that they're using. But But yeah, certainly here, that's how we're trying to differentiate anxiety, fear, stress, and worry. There's four different things. So all of that to say, we talked last week about anxiety disorders. We talked about the different categories of anxiety and what types of situations can elicit and sort of the function of some of those disorders for people. And we ended last week with beginning the conversation of, okay, so now what do we do about it?
What do we do about it? Right.
So we need to talk about treatment. And that's what today is going to be all about. What do we do about anxiety? How do we treat it? Well, the way that we manage anxiety is a three-tier approach. There are three things that we have to do to deal with anxiety. This is based upon the biological basis that we've already talked about, the biological basis that we talked about last week with the way in which our brain responds to stressors and anxiety. So there's three steps. The first thing is we have to stop the panic.
Right.
Once we stop the panic, then the person has access to their cortex, their thinking part of their brain.
Right.
We then have to restore serotonin. We'll talk about what that means in just a moment. And then thirdly, we have to deal with the anticipation. And if you remember the conversation from last week, right, we talked a lot about the fact that anxiety disorders are often associated with anticipation. What is to come? So we have to deal with those three parts. So what do you think? Let's just take these one part at a time.
Right.
So stop the panic. What do we mean by stop the panic? Well, when you think about people with anxiety disorders, they talk about it in terms of panic. Think about what people say. They say, I had a panic attack. I had an anxiety attack. And what they're talking about is an experience of intense fear, mm-hmm, that occurs associated with a stress response, the physiological stress response in their body to some stimulus in their environment. So we see that at the airport with people who have fear of flying. They'll experience an anxiety attack or a panic attack before they get onto the airplane. Sometimes people will experience that when they are about to go into a test. You know, students experience that very often, you know, especially these really high stakes testing. Lots of patients who have to take the SAT or the GRE, they'll experience intense anxiety and this stress response in their body, mm-hmm, we'll get to anticipation in just a second, but as the anticipation of the test approaches.
Right. And we also see it in people in closed spaces. People,
right.
I have a friend who, he will not ride an elevator because,
right,
the space is too small when that door closes. I worked with a woman who wanted to be not a stewardess, flight attendant.
Mm-hmm.
And in training, when the door would close to the airplane,
mm-hmm,
she would have a panic attack, mm, and she wasn't able to do that job.
Yeah.
Even just in a simulator.
Right.
When that door closed, she was in that space, the inside of an airplane was too small for her. She would have a panic attack.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So, and again, these can happen at different times for different people. Some people experience it when they have to do presentations.
Right.
Students often experience it when they have to, especially college students, when they have to get in front of the class and do,
yeah,
a workshop or a presentation to the class. They really struggle with that. And so the first step that we have to do in dealing with these things is stopping the panic. Now, that's often done with medication. And this is where some of the more controversial medications come into play.
Right.
That was the whole purpose of Xanax, for example. But there's a whole class called benzodiazepines.
Mm-hmm.
Barbiturates used to do it a little bit, but benzodiazepines are the more common ones used now, and it includes things like Xanax and Klonopin and Valium and some of those medications that work to resolve the anxiety immediately.
Right.
Now,
they're fast acting.
Right.
To deal with it immediately.
Immediately.
Right.
So a person who has to get, you have to get on the airplane despite,
right,
your fear, they can take a Xanax 30 or 45 minutes before they're going to get on the plane, and it usually will calm them enough to where they can manage it to get on the plane.
Take the flight. Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, What that does, really the only purpose of those medications is to increase a particular amino acid neurotransmitter in the brain. That is the sole purpose of those medications. And that particular substance is GABA.
Right. Which is the brain's primary inhibitory neurotransmitter.
Right. Right. And it works under the sort of assumption or the theory that GABA balances and works in conjunction with another neurotransmitter called glutamate.
Right.
That is the primary excitatory neurotransmitter. And so what happens is that as GABA, the inhibitory, decreases, glutamate, the excitatory, increases.
Right.
And so they work sort of like a seesaw. And so when a person isn't capable of calming down, meaning that they don't have enough GABA floating around in their brain, glutamate is automatically increased, and it makes them more excitatory. It makes their neurons more likely to fire, which increases anxiety, increases agitation, increases excitability, and all those kinds of things. So these medications increase GABA, so it creates a better balance, so the person's able to relax, they're able to calm. It shouldn't be surprising that that benzodiazepines work very similar to alcohol.
Right.
You know, when you think about a lot of people with anxiety disorders, when they get stressed out, what do?
Have a drink.
They have a drink. The most common place to find a person with an anxiety for flying is the bar at the airport before they go on their flight, because they'll drink a little bit of alcohol. And alcohol increases GABA in the brain. Alcohol has other problems, but that we won't get into now, but it performs a similar function. It helps relax, it helps increase that GABA in the brain so that the person can relax and be more calm.
Which also explains why people become a little more social when they're drinking, because they're less concerned.
Right.
And some of their anxieties about meeting strangers or talking to people, the alcohol sort of takes the edge off those, and it's easier to talk and relate with other people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because oftentimes those people have an underlying social anxiety, not impairing, but underlying social concerns. Mm-hmm. And yeah, absolutely, those concerns go away when you're drinking alcohol.
And if you drink too much, they go too far away.
Absolutely. Right. And then you get into trouble
and get into trouble on the other side.
Right. You're a little too social.
Right.
Your wife's not going to like that too much. You're a little too social.
Right. You have no fears, no anxieties.
That's right. And you can justify things for some reason. I don't know why. So the increasing GABA is really important. Now, there's other things that increase GABA also. Excessive food consumption increases GABA. That's why people who are stressed oftentimes stress eat.
People eat.
They watch TV. Watching TV can increase GABA. And so excessive TV watching, when you just sit there and you had that phenomenon where you're sitting there and all of a sudden it went from 12 o'clock noon and now it's midnight and all you've been doing is watching Scrubs episodes. It's relaxing because it's increasing that GABA, and time can just pass because you're not stressed. You're not anxious about what's going on or what's happening around you. Mm-hmm. So all of that happens in this first stage, that stop the panic.
Right.
Obviously, the healthier ways to deal with stopping the panic is through, you know, if you're going to go the medication route, is through these benzodiazepines. Mm-hmm. But there's other things too, like relaxation, meditation. Those are other healthy ways to deal with the panic. Mm-hmm. But being honest, being very direct about it, that's difficult.
Right.
I mean, yeah. I think it's a little naive to tell a patient who experiencing anxiety attacks, panic attacks, to say, well, when that's happening, just take some deep breaths. Well, I'm sure that they would do that if they could.
But if you're really afraid to fly, that's probably not going to work.
Right.
Right. Especially in the early stages.
In the early stages.
In the early stages of treatment, you're...
You don't have the tools.
You don't. You don't have the tools. You don't have the ability. You haven't calmed your brain enough to be able to overcome it.
Right, because if you had the tools, you would already be using them.
That's right. Right.
So during these early stages, oftentimes we do need medication. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to throw this in here real quick now, because we're gonna allude to this again as we're going through, is that all three of these stages, stopping the panic, restoring serotonin, which we're going to talk about next, and dealing with anticipatory anxiety, all of this stuff happens at the same time.
Right.
So it's not like we're going to be in a situation, or that we should be in a situation, where we say, okay, well, we're going to stop the panic with Xanax, say, mm-hmm. for the next 3 weeks. And then after we stop the panic, then we're going to start increasing serotonin.
Right.
That's not going to work. All that these medications do is calms the brain down for a particular period of time.
Right.
It doesn't do anything for the underlying cause. It doesn't do anything to decrease the likelihood of it happening again,
right.
except during the time that the medication is active in your body.
Right.
It doesn't do anything preventative.
Mm-hmm.
All it does is addresses it for the moment. So it's
like any medication, you have to use it for the purpose for which it was designed.
Right.
Okay. And this medication was for short-term treatment, so that it makes it possible for you to do whatever
right.
is difficult,
right?
Such as getting on an airplane,
right?
Or getting through a talk, or right. getting through a performance.
Well, and you're absolutely right. And if you think about it, as we talk about these things, if we build our treatment, and if patients and you listeners who are struggling with some of these things approach it in this way that we're talking about, it all works very smoothly together.
Right. Right.
These medications really are only intended to be used for about 8 weeks. We laugh a little bit when we think about that, because we've certainly had patients that we've worked with who have been on Xanax for years. But the medications really were only made to be right. used for about 2 months.
But I think there's an important point to be made here. If you have a specific phobia,
right,
fear of flying,
mm-hmm.
you would only take the medication when you're flying.
Right.
So you might take it for many years, but only when you fly.
Right.
If your anxiety is more frequent, more generalized,
right.
if you're experiencing anxiety every day, you wouldn't want to take these every day for years.
Right.
Because it's not meant to be a long-term treatment. Right. It's only meant to take care of the first phase
right.
of treatment.
That's okay. a great point. That's a great point. Because realistically, for most specific phobias, like mm-hmm. flying, fear of snakes, fear of spiders, we don't really treat those things anyways. Mm-hmm. Well, if you're afraid of flying, yep. unless you're in a situation where you have to fly,
right.
we really don't do a lot of treatment for that. Because
right.
nobody's in a situation, unless you're a pilot, but obviously you wouldn't be a pilot.
You're not going to choose flying if you're afraid.
Right. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're terrified of snakes, well, you know, just stay away from
just
snakes.
Avoid them. Right.
And that's usually the treatment that we give.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly some phobias are more difficult to avoid. You
right.
know, agoraphobia, for mm-hmm. example, you know, mm-hmm. You got to go to the grocery store.
Right.
So you can't completely avoid leaving your house and doing those things. And so those warrant treatment. But for a lot of the specific
right.
phobias, we don't. But you're absolutely right. With more generalized anxiety and more day-to-day anxiety, these medications, the benzodiazepines, the ones used to stop the panic, to calm the anxiety acutely,
right. mm-hmm.
really should not be used for more than maybe 2 months.
Few weeks, right.
And the 2 month mark is important as we get into this next section, which is
right.
restoring serotonin.
Right.
Now, serotonin is a neurotransmitter that our brain makes, very important for anxiety, very important for depression. It's made from our brain. A lot of people don't know this. Our brain cannot make it by itself.
Right.
Our brain needs tryptophan
right.
to be able to make serotonin.
Right.
Now, where do we get tryptophan? From the food that we eat. Bananas,
right.
turkey, mm-hmm. chicken. You know, it's always funny because everybody thinks that it's all the turkey that at Thanksgiving that causes everybody to nap afterward. But it's not just turkey. It's turkey, it's milk, it's bananas. There's a lot of things that we eat that have good amounts of tryptophan in it
right.
that keeps our brain capable of producing the neurotransmitters that we need
mm-hmm.
for relaxation and to regulate our mood,
right.
serotonin. So what happens with serotonin as we are experiencing these anxiety disorders is that our reserves of serotonin begin to deplete. The example that we often use is if you think about the gas in your car, okay? You fill up your car, and we'll relate that to eating tryptophan. You fill up your car, and it's got gas in it. And you can drive your car around. The faster you drive your car, the more gas you're going to use.
Right.
The more anxious you are, because if you think about anxiety as just your brain being very active, scanning the environment and doing those things, your brain is very active. The more active your brain is, the more anxious you are, the more fuel it's going to use. So the more serotonin it's going to use to help try to calm you down, because that's one of the purposes of serotonin, is to regulate your mood, regulate your emotions and things like that.
Because so, when you become anxious, you become more highly aroused.
Right.
Right. And that higher level of arousal burns up serotonin faster
right.
than a lower level of arousal.
Right.
Just as driving a car burns more gasoline, driving it fast burns up more gasoline than driving it slow.
Right, right. And so when you're driving your car, you're driving fast, so that's burning more gas. Say you go to the grocery store. When you go to the grocery store, you turn your car off. Mm-hmm. But if you didn't, if you left your car running for the hour that you were in the grocery store, obviously you're going to burn more gas then as well. Mm-hmm. And that's what anxiety does as well. For many people, especially those with generalized anxiety disorders and OCD and some of those things, the anxiety doesn't stop. They right. remain stressed in that stress response all the time. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's constantly burning
right.
their fuel, their mm-hmm. serotonin. And so their serotonin levels begin to deplete. Mm-hmm. And this can lead to depression. Low levels of serotonin often is associated with depression. And it just perpetuates your inability to decrease that right. neurological arousal. One of the important roles of serotonin. Right. And so you stay at this heightened level.
And you get one of those vicious cycles where you're burning the arousal, the increased anxiety is burning up more serotonin. You have less serotonin, so you're more prone to anxiety.
Right.
Because you don't have enough serotonin.
Absolutely.
So then you get into that downward spiral.
Mm-hmm. And it just perpetuates on itself over and over and over and over again.
Right.
So I think that it's important for people to know that when we're talking about anxiety and we talk about treatment of anxiety, there are multiple neurotransmitters that we have to focus on. And we talked about GABA, and so now we're talking about serotonin. And so when we think about medication for it, people are often surprised when their physician will put them on an SSRI or an antidepressant medication for their anxiety. And they'll say right. things like, well, I'm not depressed. Well, you're not depressed, but serotonin is also associated with anxiety. Mm-hmm. And so you may have people who are prescribed Prozac for mm-hmm. their anxiety disorder.
Right.
Or Paxil or Zoloft or mm-hmm. Lexapro or some of these other antidepressant medications whose job is really to increase serotonin.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's how some of these things tie together. When we talk about SSRIs, and some of the other antidepressant types of medications, like the tricyclic antidepressants and the selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, the SNRIs. When we talk about some of these other medications, they take some time to start working in the brain. Unlike Xanax, that starts working within 30 or 45 minutes,
right.
you have to take Prozac for a good 3 or 4 weeks before you start really seeing the effects. So, and then at that point, you have to decide, well, is this starting dose the right dose, or do I need to bump it up a little bit?
And the reason for that is it has to build up to a certain concentration in your blood system.
Right.
Right? And serotonin, the word sero, means blood.
Right.
So it just is moved by your blood system.
Right.
And so you have to get the medication at a certain concentration to get it to get a certain concentration of it in your blood system. Because
mm-hmm.
people don't understand, sero means blood.
Right.
Serotonin.
And you have that component of it. And then the other component of it is, no matter how many chemicals are in your brain, if your brain doesn't have enough receptor sites,
right.
oh man, we could get into all kinds of neurobiology here. I'm tempted, but we won't do it. But your neurons have receptor sites where it receives the serotonin. And for a lot of people who are depressed or go through these depletions, mm-hmm. your brain says, oh, well, we're not making so much serotonin. We don't need all these extra receptor sites, so it'll close them down.
They die off. Right?
And so when you start taking the medication, your brain has to say, oh, well, I guess we do need those. And so they'll open them back up, but it takes a little bit of time for that to happen. So when you are taking the SSRIs, you have to take them every day. You have to take them consistently. And it takes sometimes 4 to 8 weeks to really get in there and start working and to make sure that you're on the right dose.
Right.
Now, why is that 8 week thing important?
To Xanax.
That's how long Xanax is there to help us. So if you're taking Xanax for 8 weeks to stop the panic, and at the same time, you're building up your serotonin levels through the use of SSRIs or some of the other antidepressants, by the time that 2 month period is up, you should be able to stop the Xanax because the other medications are now effective. And so your chemicals start becoming more regulated. That's how these things are supposed to work together. Now, oftentimes that doesn't happen because what that would mean, and patients oftentimes don't like it, what that will often mean is that the first visit to the psychiatrist will result in them leaving with at least two prescriptions.
Right.
A prescription for Xanax and a prescription for Prozac or some other anti-anxiety medication or antidepressant. Patients oftentimes don't like that. But this is the reason why we see that tendency occurring, is because we're dealing with two different neurotransmitters and we have to get them regulated before the brain can get back where it needs to be.
Right. So this is step one and step two, or phase one and phase two.
Right.
Phase one is take care of the panic. Phase two is to increase serotonin.
Right.
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 So that's why it's two medications.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Now, all the while, we need to be working on teaching the patient or the patient, him or herself, learning how to manage some of these things on their own.
Because the medication isn't going to address the cause.
Right.
It's going to address what's going on in your brain.
Right.
It's going to help, but it's not addressing the underlying cause or reason.
Right. And the medications from phase one and two make you more available to learn the skills and things that you need to develop the tools that you need to develop for the anxiety, for the anticipatory anxiety component associated with these disorders.
Because the anxiety disorders are in response to threats in our environment.
Right.
And we say that we are triggered. Those are triggers that serve to... the anxiety gets triggered by something in the environment. It might be a snake. It might be the doors of an elevator closing. It might be the fear of public places. It might be fear of germs or some animal. But it's in response to... And what we want to do in phase three is to identify what that trigger is.
Right.
And that's the whole goal of phase three.
Right.
What is the trigger? What is the trigger that's causing this, and how do we deal with that?
Right. And we build up skills and strategies for managing that.
Right.
So a lot of times, they're just thoughts. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked with patients who, you know, they just have a underlying dread that something bad is going to happen.
Right.
Where does that come from? Okay. We may or may not get to the actual root of that. Mm-hmm. But what we can do is we can develop strategies for when that happens, when those thoughts come, this is how we're going to respond to it. Here's a series of tools that you can use to cope with that and to stop those thoughts and do different things. There's four or five or maybe even more different types of thoughts and processes that influence the development or the sort of exacerbate some of these anxieties. You have obsessions. We talked about that a little bit last week, but these are thoughts that for some people you just cannot get rid of. They're thoughts that go over and over in your mind. We call it rumination, where you're just going over the same thing over and over and over again, and you're not able to stop those thoughts. Another one is cognitive distortions. And the third one is automatic thoughts. These are ideas proposed by a very well-known psychologist, Aaron Beck. And he was talking mostly about depression, but it certainly applied to anxiety disorders as well, where people who have these conditions have these automatic thoughts that come to their mind. They don't necessarily elicit them themselves. They don't actively think about these things. But for some reason, for these individuals, the first thought that comes to their mind is negative. They can't help it. If they do poorly on a test, or if they're running late, their first thought is, I'm always late. I'll never be able to pass this test. And those kinds of negative thoughts are just perpetuated, and they just continue and continue and continue. And usually, 99 times out of 100, those thoughts are inaccurate because they're absolute, they're definitive, and we sort of generalize them to every aspect of life when we have these negative cognitive distortions. And so they use words like, I will never be able to pass this test. Well, you know, that's probably not true. And one of the things we do in therapy is we try to help the patient identify situations where it wasn't true. Okay, well, tell me, how did you do in the last test? Well, I got a B on the last test. Well, so certainly you can pass the test.
Okay, right.
You are capable of it. I have a patient I'm working with now who's experiencing a lot of depression. And that is what we're working on, is we're trying to identify and verify that, look, you can get through this. It will get better. We use that with all of our patients who are struggling with anxiety and depression. The cognitive distortions is a way that your brain is trying to trick you, for lack of a better word. Your brain is just trying to hijacked by these negative thoughts. So obsessions, cognitive distortions, automatic thoughts, dread. Patients tend to, or people with anxiety and depression, tend to immediately go to the worst case scenario. There is no in between for folks who are struggling with these things. It's either nothing or the worst case scenario. And so people who have these difficulties immediately go to that.
We call that catastrophizing.
Yes.
Right.
That's it.
They go to, it's going to be catastrophic.
Right.
You know, and typically it isn't.
Right.
But that's where our thoughts take us.
Right. Right. Yeah. You think about sort of the classic case of social anxiety. Mm-hmm. The teenager in those situations, their immediate thought is, if I do that, everybody's going to laugh at me,
right,
because I'm going to fall on my face, or I'm mm-hmm. going to make this kind of mistake. Mm-hmm. That usually doesn't happen.
Right.
And it's this...
The plane usually doesn't crash.
Right, right.
But that's the catastrophe. You think it's going to. I mean, that's your fear.
Right.
Your irrational fear. And that's the catastrophe that you're thinking about.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And then the last thing is perseverations. And people tend to perseverate when they're struggling with this. And so they'll take situations, and again, they kind of ruminate over it. So they go over it over and over and over again. And then it just continues to grow. It just continues to go on and on and on. And they'll start to apply those same worries or anxieties or stressors to everything else in their life. Well, that person doesn't like me. You know, I really don't have any friends. Well, that type of perseveration is problematic because, again, 9 times out of 10, it's not true.
Right.
And we can find examples to demonstrate that.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, we're working to stop the panic. We're working to restore serotonin. And all the while, we're working to identify some of the sources of these worries, some of the sources of these anxieties, the thoughts that are in there that may not necessarily be the snake sitting in front of you, but it's the things that we think about that continue to go over and over in our mind that exacerbate those anxious responses. And so we use therapeutic techniques like cognitive behavioral therapy. There's a whole bunch of different ones. But we use those therapeutic techniques to try to decrease mm-hmm. that anticipation.
And the different therapeutic techniques have been designed to address these different things.
Right.
For example, you have a therapeutic technique for obsessive thoughts, but you have a different therapeutic technique for perseverations.
Right.
So you select the... sometimes people will ask, well, I want you to do cognitive behavioral therapy. Well, it depends what the person is struggling with.
Right.
You select the therapy based on the thought process that you're concerned about.
Right.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in some therapeutic techniques are just not good for some people.
Right.
Cognitive behavioral therapy, I'm glad you mentioned that one, because it's very common.
Right.
But cognitive behavioral therapy really is only good for people who can think that way. You know, it requires some level of insight.
Mm-hmm.
So it requires some level of metacognition. Okay, how are you thinking about this? Thinking about how you're thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It requires that level of cognition.
Right.
And if you ain't got it...
If you're too young, for example.
Right.
If you're too young to have it, or if you're... If your brain just doesn't work that way,
right,
you're not going to be able to do it.
Right.
Right.
People who are very concrete have difficulty with cognitive behavioral therapy.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we have to use another technique.
If you're afraid of snakes or spiders,
mm-hmm.
then you do exposure therapy.
Exposure therapy.
Because that's been more... I mean, you can use cognitive behavioral therapy, but a quicker treatment is exposure therapy.
Right.
For those kinds of phobias. So you select your therapy based on the problem that...
Right.
You're having.
Right. You have to look at what's going on, and you have to look at the person, him or herself,
right,
as you're making those decisions.
Right.
A lot of the things that we do is we recommend, you know, people who best cope with anxiety and stress and worry and all those different things that are going on in their bodies, people who respond best to those are people who have some control over their body. People who do right. yoga, for example,
right.
People who do meditation, right. oftentimes those folks are really good at relieving those stress responses,
right.
They're able to relax, they're able to calm themselves, and they can manage their anxiety much right. better
right.
than people who have difficulty with that.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times we will teach, it's not really cognitive behavioral,
right.
but it's just another technique that you can that we will teach people sometimes to try to help them cope with this. And what does yoga and relaxation techniques do? Meditation, mm-hmm. what do? They increase GABA,
right.
which is the same thing that we use the medication for. And so if during the time that the person is using the medication to bring it down to a manageable level, if we're teaching them then intrinsic ways that they can do it themselves, not a non-medication based ways to do the same thing, as those skills build, then the medications can be weaned off. And so then the person becomes capable of managing their stress on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all of this stuff needs to happen at the same time. Diet. Man, I've been listening to a lot of workshops and stuff lately about the relationship between diet and anxiety. And this idea of inflammation. You know, we eat a lot of things that cause inflammation in our bodies. Dairy, wheat products, you know, some preservatives and things, it creates inflammation in our body, which causes stress.
It's a stress.
Increases the stress response in our right. in our body as well as our brain, and causes problems.
Right.
And so, you know, there are things that we do voluntarily. Tobacco. For some people, well, briefly about nicotine, right? Nicotine gets a really bad rap. And the first thing that we need to do, I would want to do is differentiate nicotine from smoking.
Right.
Smoking is bad for you.
Right.
There's no easy way around it. Smoking is bad for you. I know a lot of people are using e-cigarettes now. We don't know yet what the long-term effects are going to be of e-cigarettes and what's going to happen as a result of all the vaporizing of the substances and ingesting that. But smoking, by and large, it is not good for you. Nicotine at appropriate levels isn't that bad for you.
Right.
You know, we're born and we're created. Our brain has nicotinic receptors in it, which is why it's so addicting. Our brain wants nicotine. Mm-hmm. It's part of the acetylcholine system, and it helps with memory and concentration and focus. So that's why we are often drawn to it. Well, nicotine is a fascinating substance that has two effects. It is a stimulant and a depressant almost at the same time. That's why we people who smoke when they first get up in the morning to get themselves going. It's acting as a stimulant there. And that's why they smoke after dinner or after other activities to help them relax.
Right.
So it has this dual effect. But because it works as a stimulant, for some people, smoking a cigarette increases anxiety. It makes you more anxious. I've worked with people in the past who, you know, they will, because of this, they will, they start dipping, and they, you know, we live in Central Florida, so smokeless tobacco is very common. My grandfather used to, anyways. But that tobacco, or more specifically the nicotine, for some people really makes things worse. So initially it may help them feel like they're relaxing, but the next stage of it is sort of additional stimulation that causes stress and just makes their anxieties worse. So there are things that we eat, things that we ingest, whether it's nicotine or tobacco. There are things that we do to ourselves voluntarily that have an effect on our anxiety. And so that's another thing that we do as that third phase of treatment, is we need to look at that stuff and figure out, okay, what can we do to manage this to decrease its impact on our anxiety and how we're able to relax and calm ourselves. I got off on a tangent there with nicotine.
It's okay.
We did a lot of research with nicotine when I was at the University of South Florida. And I'm always fascinated with nicotine.
Interesting substance, very addictive.
It is, mm-hmm. It is. And you know, our ancestors used it for a long time for different things. So interesting stuff. So and we don't really have time to get into some of the things that we could talk about as relates to more naturopathic ways of dealing with it, like omega-3. My goodness, omega-3 is so important. I was just listening to a conference last week, and they were saying that up in Canada, the daily allowance of omega-3, the recommended upper level of the dose, is up to 5,000 milligrams a day. That's tremendous.
Much higher than anything we've seen.
But, you know, I'm working on having a physician come in for us to interview who is functional medicine physician to come in and kind of talk about some of these things, because, you know, we think about supplements and those kinds of things, but it really comes down to our diet. You know, we can take individual supplements and that's all well and good, but a lot of times we need other substances to make those substances work. Omega-3 is really great, but unless you have enough B vitamin and magnesium and zinc and iron and things like that in your system, your body's not going to be able to use the omega-3 the way that it needs to. So it's much more complex than going and getting some fish oil and taking that. There's a lot more to it. So, but we'll get into that another day. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
Okay. So we have these three stages.
Right.
This is how we need to manage anxiety. It's not an easy road. Some people really struggle.
It takes time and patience. There's no quick fix for this, except for Xanax.
Right.
You know, but we've talked about the dangers, and it's meant for short-term use. But this is a process that takes time and patience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we try to impress on you as the listener, you as the person who may be struggling with anxiety, mm-hmm. that it is a path that you have to continue on. You know, right. A lot of people who struggle with anxiety, they jump on the path for treatment, then they jump off the path because they get frustrated or because they're not seeing immediate effects.
Get discouraged.
And you know, you have to stay on the path because that's the way that you're going to manage it.
Right. It takes a while to change the brain. You don't change. People talk about brain plasticity. That's in the. It's on TV now. It takes a long time to change a brain.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something you do in a couple of days or a couple of weeks.
Right.
It takes time to change these brain processes.
Right. It's just like any other part of your body that you want to, you know, if you want to tone your arm muscles, it takes work. You have to do it over a period of time, mm-hmm. and you have to keep at it.
Right.
So if you want to make positive changes in your brain, you have to work at it. And it's uncomfortable sometimes. It's discouraging sometimes. Because you'll struggle, but if you keep at it, mm-hmm. and you do some of the things that you know, if you seek help and you get professional help with these things, you're going to find that it will get better. You may always have that underlying tendency towards anxiety, but it will get better.
Tendency is a good word. Yeah. You know, some people have a tendency to be this way, but there are treatments and they're effective.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, all right. Anything else we needed to talk about today?
Well, there are some specific techniques, but we're not going to have... It would take too long now. We're almost at the end of the hour, aren't we?
Yeah, we're getting close.
Okay, well, we can do that another time. Okay. About specific treatments, both... we've talked about the medical, and there are psychotherapeutic techniques, and there are also some health changes that people can make. Exercise and teas and... aromatherapy that some people have found to be very effective.
Yeah.
We can talk about those.
Yeah, there's that whole metronome project that's working.
Interactive metronome helped some kids. Some parents have reported that their kids respond to lavender, you know, in different aromatherapies or baths with magnesium, with Epsom salts. And so there are some non-traditional sort of, what did you call them?
Naturopathic
approaches that people have found to be useful.
Yeah. Okay.
So we'll talk about those.
Yeah.
Another time.
And we would love to hear from any of you listeners who have maybe experienced anxiety and found something that was useful for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we work with a lot of patients with anxiety, but you know, certainly there are always new things for us to learn to try to help patients. You know, there's more research and new things coming out all the time about the potential benefits of this or that. And, you know, we try to stay on top of what the research says for those things so that we can provide our patients with the best possible treatment. And so we would love to hear from you if you've tried something that you found very effective or if you tried something that wasn't very effective that maybe you're hearing a lot of people talk about and you tried it and you think, wow, that didn't do anything for me. We'd love to hear that too, just because, you know, we're all different people. And so there may be some sets of people who do very well with a particular treatment technique and some people who don't do very well with that particular technique. And so we can start to tailor and be more specific with our patients and with people that we're trying to work with. Yeah. So, our goal always is to share that information with you so that you're more informed and you're more capable of educating yourself as it relates to any and all of these things that we try to talk about on this podcast. So,
and as always, treatment in children is different and more difficult than treatment in adults.
Yes.
So don't be discouraged if you're a parent with a child with anxiety. It is a little more difficult in dealing with this in young children. And the younger the child is, the more difficult it is than it is dealing with it in adults. Typically, adults want to change. They want to come to terms with it. And so it makes treatment much easier because they're motivated and they want to deal with it. Typically, children want to hang on to it because it's comforting because they have their parents right there. And so it's a little bit different dealing with this in children. So don't be discouraged if you have a child who has elevated anxiety.
Right. And it gets back to the insight that we were talking about earlier. I mean, kids just don't understand that what they're experiencing is anxiety. Mm-hmm. They experience the same things that we do as adults.
It's pretty hard to tell a child you're having an irrational thought.
Right.
You know, an adult gets that, but kids don't. Their thoughts are real.
Yeah, yeah. So, saw a kid yesterday who's terrified of ghosts. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, have you ever seen a ghost in your house? No. Well, have you ever seen a ghost at all? No. Well, why are you afraid of ghosts? Well, there could be one out there.
That's right.
But he loves dragons.
That's right.
And so he loves dragons. Well, have you ever seen a dragon? No. Mm-hmm. Has a dragon ever come to your house? No. Well, why do you like dragons? Well, they could be out there. You know, it works on both sides.
Very different in children.
So very fascinating. But that's why we love working with kids.
Right.
Is because it's you never know what's going to walk
next
in the door.
Right.
So,
right.
But we love it, and we love working with parents and trying to help them understand what's going on with their kids because it's always a mystery. So
we'll do what we can.
All right. Well, we did all the announcements at the beginning, right? So check out their websites. Write to us. We'd love it if you would write a review on iTunes, just a few sentences about what you think about the podcast, if you like it, if you don't like it. We'd love to hear any of them. Hopefully you like it.
And with school starting, that's going to produce that anxiety that we talked about earlier. Yeah. So give us a call, send us an email, tweet,
right,
Facebook, however you want to communicate with us. Let us know how school is going and how your children are doing. And we'll be here to answer any questions you might have.
Right. And it is going to be September 18th that we're doing our workshop on anxiety. We'd mm-hmm. love for you guys to make it out there. We'd love to fill the room.
Meet each other.
We try to meet everybody that's mm-hmm. at the workshops so that we can put faces to names and mm-hmm. Really help everyone as best we can deal with some of these things that cause distress and frustration. So check out the website. It's pacflorida.com, pacflorida.com, or our blog at thementalbreakdown.com. Facebook, The Mental Breakdown's on Facebook. PAC Florida's on Facebook. Twitter. I started a Pinterest account. Man, there's a lot of neat things on Pinterest. I just discovered that. It's been around for a long time, but
that are distracting.
Yes. So check us out on Pinterest. It's Dr. Bernie on Pinterest. I think I'm going to change that to PAC Florida on Pinterest, but I haven't figured out how to do that yet. So
I'm cringing on the other side of the table.
I'm not going to go into why he's cringing. It's because he doesn't do any of these things.
He's not going to go in, but he is going
to. But I am going to. All right. It's, you know, we could just sit here and talk all day. So
we are click and clack.
Yes. We'll take over. So, again, just appreciate anything that you guys would like to share with us. Anything we can do to help, we're always here, always available, and always interested. So until next time, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Have a great week. Good luck going back to school. Yes. And it's going to be a great year. Man, I love school. It's great.
Thank you for listening to The Mental Breakdown. If you want more information, you can check out our website at www.pacflorida.com. The Mental Breakdown is sponsored in part by theledger.com, where you can read our weekly column in the Life section. Our podcasts are available for download on iTunes, and you can follow us on our YouTube channel and Facebook. We would love to hear from you, so feel free to send us messages either through our website or on Facebook. You can send us questions or topics you would like for us to address on future podcasts. Drs. Bernie and Richard are available for workshops, so you can contact us for more information. Thank you for listening, and until next time, stay mentally healthy.